Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what people should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests of both experiences and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. We also do invite call-ins during the show to ask questions and make comments. We'd like to encourage you to please support Toward the Light and this radio show by making a donation and also taking advantage of the services and support offered through Toward the Light. For more information, please visit our website, towardthelight.org and towardthelight.info. This week I am so pleased to have someone as a special guest who has done tremendous work in the work of research for near-death experiences, deathbed visions or deathbed phenomena as it's often referred to. Let us welcome to Toward the Light from London, Dr. Peter Finnick. Hello, Doctor. How are you?
Hi. Good evening, Julia. It's nice to chat to you.
It's so wonderful to have you with us. And I remember that when you gave a wonderful lecture at the IANS conference in Chicago, Illinois, back in 2004, you did such a tremendous job. And I was so excited by what you had to say and all of the work that you've done. And I remember sitting next to PMH Atwater, we were both jumping up and down with glee at all the things that you were sharing with us. And I would like to ask you, what is it that actually got you into the study and research? What brought your interest to the near-death experience?
Well, I certainly agree with you. That was a great meeting. What got me into the research was that I had a patient come into my office, and he told me that he had just had a cardiac catheter and that the cardiac catheter had gone wrong, and he'd become unconscious, and then he'd always unconscious to the people who were watching him.
Yes.
his heart stopped, and he left his body, and he watched the resuscitation process, and then he came back into his body again. And he was really very frightened by the whole thing. And next day, when the physician came up to him and said, "But we'll have to do it again because it went wrong yesterday," he just left the hospital. He couldn't stand the thought of going through that again. And he had a chronic anxiety state. And so I had an opportunity of studying somebody who, although their heart wasn't functioning, they said that they, in fact, could see the resuscitation process, and that was new.
So did he share this information with you and or with somebody else?
He shared it with me. I was the first person he'd talked to about it, apart from his wife. He tried to talk to other people about it, but nobody was really interested.
So you were quite an understanding individual from the get-go with this. You didn't tell him that he needed psychiatric evaluation, which, of course, you are a psychiatrist, so that's very interesting. What year was this that this happened?
This was way back in about 86, something like that.
Okay. Yes, because I know that even at that time, there wasn't a whole lot circulating about the NDE, at least not to my knowledge, and maybe
no,
I'm...
No, you're correct.
Okay.
And what we did after that is I didn't think that these things happened. Well, certainly not in the UK. Maybe California, but not in the UK. And to find one that actually occurred in the UK made me feel we had to study it. And so together with Margot Gray, a study was set up at one of the hospitals in England, Guy's Hospital.
Yes.
And we found near-death experiences then. It was quite clear that they were real like we think they are today.
So were people open about sharing their experiences? Did you do outreach and invite people to participate in a research project, or how did that all start?
Well, soon after I found this person, we started our research program. I was approached by a producer of the program who said that he very much wanted to make a film on near-death experiences. And his name was Tony Edwards, and he made a what's called a QED film. It was a BBC documentary film.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
On near-death experiences. And that went out in England, I think it was 1987. And it was amazing because it was the first time that many people had been introduced to the idea of near-death experiences. And we got over 1,000 letters. People just wrote in saying, thank you so much for the film. I've never been able to speak to anybody about this before. And we were really excited by the fact that we had so much information. And that led to the first book that my wife and I wrote, which we did basing it on the 1,000 letters, which was called The Truth and the Light. And we really went on with our research from that point.
Well, you've done some tremendous work with this, and what really impressed me so much about your lecture, which, of course, I have got that included on towardthelight.org, and our listeners, if you go to towardthelight.org/Finnick lecture, you'll be able to read the entire lecture that Dr. Finnick gave. It was so wonderful, and you know, being an experiencer, of course, I'm really excited about anything that is going to help validate the near-death experience and to make the distinction between that and an hallucination, which are two completely different things. And so when you were talking about this and with your presentation, you were showing the fact that an NDE actually happens whilst one is flatlined and
yes, that's right. And there are several pieces of evidence which lead to this. There's the work of previous doctors in the field. Dr. Seb Baum is one who did a correlation between what the person who had the NDE said he saw occurring when his EEG was flat and when his heart had stopped, and what actually happened. And he found a correlation. Now, we've done a number of studies, and we've done one with a doctor called Dr. Penny Sartori, and she's just finished her PhD. And she had a number of people who lost consciousness because their heart stopped and left their bodies and watched the resuscitation process. And she did something very clever. She took the accounts of people whose heart wasn't working, and they said they'd seen the resuscitation, and she got them to describe it, and she rated it. And she used as a control group those people whose hearts had stopped, but they hadn't seen the resuscitation because they were unconscious. And what she found was that those people who said they'd seen the resuscitation scored much more highly with regards to what actually happened compared to those who didn't. This is really the first time that we have good objective evidence that people who say they leave their body and watch the resuscitation process when their heart is stopped probably, in fact, do just that.
That's tremendous. When was this project done? And also feel free to describe more of the tests that you facilitated, because it's, you know, to me it's very critical to get the message out there that there really is a difference between an out-of-body experience and the hallucination that so many people will still try to chalk it up as, you know. And
yes, well, this project was done over the last 5 years, but really very exciting now with Dr. Sam Parnia, who works with me. Sam and I work together.
Okay.
We have already 10 UK hospitals in which boards have been put up in the coronary care rooms. And we are waiting for a number of people to have cardiac arrests there, leave their bodies and see the boards. This is actually being set up at the present moment. And so we're very excited about this. And when this has been fully set up, and we hope it will be in about 18, 20 hospitals in all, then I think we'll be really able to get the answer to this. And it's going to be something like this. If you have a cardiac arrest, you leave your body, and you're able to see the targets, which we have in the rooms, and then you're able to tell the people about it afterwards, what they saw, etc. Then if you can do that, then clearly we'll have indisputable evidence that when the brain is non-functional, people are able to gain information. And that means that we'll have to rethink our neuroscience.
And do you talk openly with the staff of these hospitals, and is there a sort of orientation or course that people are given so that they understand this more readily and can make clear decisions about dealing with different procedures?
Yes, that's all taken into account, because in the UK, as in the USA, the ethics committee is extremely important, and to get ethical permission for these studies is very, very important. So we have to put our whole study before the ethics committee. They look at it and see whether or not they think what we're doing is ethical. And if it is, they give us permission to go ahead. And that's what we've done. And then we talk to the physicians of the hospital. And we have something which I'm not sure you have in the States, and they're called resuscitation officers. These are people at the hospital who go to every cardiac arrest and make sure that the resuscitation process has been carried out correctly. And so the resuscitation officers are very key in this project, because they know everybody who's had a cardiac arrest. And so we can identify these people and ask them questions after.
Well, I think this is really a very positive thing. This time has come. And also the fact that, thank goodness now, there has been so much more discussion about the near-death experience and, openly, which is very, very good compared to, for example, when so many of us had our huge transformative NDEs in the mid-70s, and there was nowhere we could go without people judging us and thinking that we'd had a hallucination or what have you. But now there's a lot more information circulating about the near-death experience, and I'm so pleased about that. And, of course, I had my NDEs back in the UK as well as experiencing some stuff in America, and I admit I'm not very familiar with the procedures in America, because I quite frankly have had nothing to do with hospitals for many, many years. I avoid them completely.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do.
Yeah, I think so too. And yet people like you and Dr. Pim van der Mill have just done amazing work with, bringing this out into the open. On the another thing that I would also like to address, that I'm very excited about your work, because I think this ties in as well. I've got your article that you recently sent me about the deathbed vision, the deathbed phenomena. And so that's another interesting thing that you're working on, because you are communicating again, I would imagine, with the staff of different hospitals.
Yes. That is a very lovely project, and it's an interesting one, because the questions which we've been asking is what happens just before you die, that is in the week to the fortnight before you die. And some other cultures, like the Tibetan cultures, have a very formal scheme of what happens, but in the West, we have really very little knowledge of it. We don't actually know what the mental states are in people before they die. And I think this is because we have a very mechanistic view. You know, dying is just turning the brain off and that's the end of it.
So we
decided that we'd look at this. And what we found is it's not like that at all. In the week before death, we've been looking at the carers of the dying, and this word comes from the carers of the dying, not from the dying themselves.
Right.
And what we find is that the dying talk with their carers. They can be relatives or they can be professional carers. And about a week before they die, they say that they see family members who have come specifically to collect them. And they actually talk to the family members, and the dying talk to the family members. And we have wonderful accounts of sometimes the family see the people who've come, their dead family members who come, usually grandmother, grandfather, maybe other members of the family. And they're specifically there to help, and they're specifically there to help the dying person through the dying process. And the dying talk about going on a journey, and they're very accurate. And many of them say, tomorrow I'll be going on a journey with so-and-so, who's the family, dead family member who's come to pick them up. So it's a very exciting phenomenon. And these are called deathbed visions,
yeah.
And of course they've been known for a very long time. But what we haven't understood is how common they are. I did a television program in England talking about these things, and we got over 1,000 emails from people giving us examples of what happens before people die. The first one is deathbed visions. Now, the next one is called deathbed coincidences. And this is when, at the moment of death, the dying person communicates with somebody, usually another family member or somebody they're close to tell them that they're dying. And the message they give is, I'm dying, but I'm okay. And most of them say that they are maybe awoken at night, or maybe it's during the day. At night, they sometimes see the dying person, and they get reassured that the dying person has just died at that moment, but that they're going to be okay. And this happens when the people don't know that their relatives are dying, and it's a fascinating occurrence. It's as if the mind of the dying person is able to reach out to those they love and in some way interact with them.
That's a strong telepathy going on there, absolutely.
Yes, and that's at the moment of death. Now,
yeah.
The third thing are what are called deathbed phenomena, and these are really interesting. This is, again, at the moment of death, people who are in the room with the dying say they see things leaving the body. Quite often the body is surrounded, at the moment of death or the time of death, surrounded by light. And sometimes when things leave the body, people say it's associated with very strong feelings of compassion and love.
Yes.
And occasionally people say they also hear music at this time as well. Now, there are a lot of phenomena that happen just as the person is dying. But it goes beyond that. Julie, do you remember the old song about the grandfather clock? I don't know if you have it in the States.
Well, I'm from England, so yes, I do, of course.
And in which it stopped dead, never to go again, when the old man died.
Yeah.
Well, we have had lots of clock stories. And that is that at the time of death, people's clocks really do stop. And I thought it was only going to be mechanical clocks, but it's not. People's electrical clocks stop as well. And in a number of institutions where we've been carrying out our research, the nurses report that bells go off, and if sometimes animals are involved in the process as well,
yes.
they tend to be very disturbed and upset the time that somebody's died. So it's a very complex thing, dying, and it's a wonderful thing because it looks as if the whole process is looked after for us in a way that we had no idea before.
I know, and that's something that makes me tremendously excited as well, because I've always known, I'm not going to say believe, I'm going to have the audacity to say that I've always known that life is eternal, that we do not lose consciousness or selfhood when we leave our bodies behind. And a few years ago, whilst I was in Nashville, Tennessee, I was with a hospice volunteer. And she took me to the hospice and actually gave me a pamphlet that's routinely handed out to, I think, volunteers and staff alike about the dying process. And I read it, and I thought, well, this is all well and good. It's a beginning, but it was written by somebody who's never been there. So what I did was, through that experience, I was inspired to write an article, The Dying Process, from an experiencer's perspective. And I wrote about my experiences of dying, the actual transitioning process, and then being on the other side. And I feel that this kind of stuff should be a must read, and these should be lectures that should be required study in medical school, because there is so much that is going on, as you and I are talking about, when one is getting ready to transition, that one can't just hypothesize about it. There's so many layers to it. And I experienced so many of these things myself, and I also remember a friend who was in nursing school in Liverpool, and she went to a patient and proceeded to try to wake him up, and he didn't respond, and she panicked, and she said, "Oh, my God," and she was shaking him. And then he said, "Oh, you just drew me out of the most beautiful dream." And he was talking to a loved one. I don't remember who it was, if it was his mom or his wife, but I'm going to just say it was his wife. And so they were having this beautiful dialogue, and then my friend Omar sort of aroused him and brought him back into his body. And then he described to her what happened. And then shortly thereafter, he did transition. So he was met with his loved one, just as we've been talking about in the deathbed visions. And, I just think it's very critical that people realize, you know, that these people are not losing it. They're not losing their minds. These are real interdimensional experiences and telepathic communion that they are having. Who are some of the people that you've been working with in these projects, and are you still doing some projects now with regards to this?
Yes, I have two wonderful people working with me. The first one is a nurse called Sue Brain, and she has had great experience with sitting with the dying and working with the dying, and another lovely nurse called Hillary, and she also has spent a lot of time sitting with the dying and worked in hospices with the dying, so they're both extremely knowledgeable. And what we've done is we have gone to, we've first of all talked to a palliative care team in the UK. Palliative care doctors and nurses look after those who are dying, but much more important, we've gone to hospices and asked the hospice staff what they've seen. We've also done it in nursing homes as well. So we're beginning to get quite a good feel for what actually goes on in the nursing homes. We've found a number of things. One of the first things is people, staff in the nursing homes are very unwilling to talk about these phenomena because there is a reluctance one could almost say taboo, but it's much more a reluctance to talk about them. And if you do, the other people, the other staff in the hospice, don't always receive what you've observed properly. They don't actually accept it. So that's one thing. The next thing is that many of the staff feel that they haven't been trained properly. They don't know how to deal with these very meaningful experiences that the dying have. And just saying, oh, it's a hallucination, oh, it's due to the drugs, just doesn't help the people who've had the experience, because it's so strong and it's so important to them that they know that that's not the right explanation. And then the next thing that we wanted to find out is how frequent is it? Well, in order to do that, we have to teach the people in the hospice what to look out for, and this we've done. And then we go back a year later and find out how many events have occurred in the year while we've been away. And we're getting a number of reports back showing that they really do occur and occur with a relatively great frequency. And I think I mentioned that I did this television program, and we got over 1,000 emails. And if any of the people on your program would like to email in, I'd always be grateful for any more experiences that people have. I think they're just wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. And feel free to give out your email address that you would like these people to respond to, please.
Can I give it to you now, Julia?
Yes.
It's Peter, that's P-E-T-E-R, with an underscore. That's not the hyphen. It's the other one on the hyphen key. It's an underline. So Peter underscore Fennick, that's an F-E-N-W-I-C-K, that's F. E-N-W-I-C-K at CompuServe, C-O-M-P-U-S-E-R-V-E. That's C-O-M-P-U-S-E-R-V-E, CompuServe.com. So Peter underscore Fennick at CompuServe.com. And we'd love to hear from you. We really would.
Oh, that would be tremendous. Because one of my questions indeed was, I wanted to ask you about further training and study that's being offered around this, because, you know, even now, even with all this publicity and dialogue going on about the near-death experience, about deathbed phenomena, etc., and just about dying, there's still so much of this stigma and this taboo factor going on, and people being in denial and not wanting to talk about it, or some people still insisting that it's an hallucination. What can we do to help alleviate these thoughts and the fear? Because, again, I think it's vitally important that people be educated, especially staff.
Yes. Now, I absolutely agree with that. And I think it's the first thing to do is to start with the staff. And what we're doing now is we're putting together a module which we'll be able to take into hospices, because most of the hospices have study days, and we'll be able to go in and talk more directly about these phenomena. So that's one thing. The next thing is that one or two of the hospices have asked if we could write a pamphlet about this that they could have, not only for the staff, but also one that they could show to their patients. And so we're doing that. What I would dearly like to do, and we haven't started on this yet, is to produce a CD of stories. And so to interview some of the people who saw these things happen when their loved ones were dying, or other members of the family were dying, and get them just to give an account of it, then put these all together on a CD and send those around to the hospices so that people in the hospice can play these and hear these stories before they're so ill that they're coming up to the actual dying process itself, and begin to understand just a little about the sorts of things that will happen when they do come towards death.
Well, I would like to offer you, you are more than welcome to use my article in part or its entirety if you'd like, because I think that that could really be helpful in so many ways. And it's quite detailed, but again, it is from the perspective of one who's been there. And I really am focused on doing anything I can to help, also to, you know, alleviate the fear of death, number one, and to help remove the stigma around death and dying, because, of course, I experience death as an illusion. There really is no such thing as just like moving house. We just move from one place to another and actually have an upsurge of energy and of frequency. And I know also, as you are describing the different the deathbed visions that people have, there is such a consistency in all of this. And
I think that's absolutely right. And once you have sat down and read story after story after story, you begin to feel very strongly that this isn't just things which people, the dying, are making up. It's not like that at all.
No.
These are real things that are happening. And they all fit such a fixed pattern. As I was saying earlier, the dying, particularly in the deathbed visions, they see their relatives, they come in, their dead relatives, it's always a dead relative, the dead relatives come in, and they talk to the dying person. Sometimes the dying person will introduce family members to them, saying to their sons or daughters who are around in the room with them, look, please meet my mother, she's come here to pick me up. So they're very real. And occasionally the relatives see them as well.
The relatives sometimes
see them and the dying see them.
There's been a lot of that spontaneity where, you know, that the caregiver or the guest, the relative is visiting, will actually also simultaneously see the deceased individual who is visiting the dying person. And I'm
so
pleased you mentioned
that. Right. And that's wonderful. And
I think so.
The dying person is very specific in why they've come. They don't say, let's go out to a film together or something like that. It's nothing like that. They've come for a very specific reason, and the reason is to help the dying person through the process of death. And they always say, we're going on a journey, we're going up, we're moving. Do you see? It's really always a continuation. It's not an ending.
Exactly. One thing I wanted to share about this, too, that just struck me that I think is notable is the fact that, from my experience, again, when I was dying, I would share an experience. I noticed that the ego and the attachments and the emotional, being emotionally charged, as it were, all that fades as we get closer to death. So there is no trying to save face or appear to be sane or whatever. We would just share exactly and authentically what is actually going on from our experience. And again, just being very matter of fact. And I'm not saying that this is true with everybody. I know some people will still be feeling a sense of anxiety even as they're getting ready to transition, although I do believe that that is more rare, that most people, the closer they get to transitioning, the more peace they feel. But I was just noting that the ego does tend to dissipate more, so I would see little or no reason for someone to try to make something up. I don't think they would even know how to fabricate something at that point, if that makes sense to you. What do you think about that?
That makes absolutely perfect sense, because remember that as you come up to this point in the death process, you're extremely ill. They're very weak. Many of them can only just speak. And so the whole idea that you're attached to anything is long gone, and you're very much involved with the dying process itself. And I think there are a number of points that you raise, one of which is that we should be taught very specifically how to die well.
Yes.
And one of the points, I think, which is important, is to make sure that you solve as far as you can any outstanding difficulties that you have with other family members, particularly before you die. In fact, come to terms with your relationships. That makes for a much better, easier death than if you're still hanging on to relationships which you haven't solved. So I think that's one thing that we should teach. And I'd go back again to what you were saying, and which I think is terribly important, and that is that the data suggests, and we're running with data here, so it's not a question of belief. This is what the dying actually say. But it's not the end. It is part of a transition. It's part of a movement. And in their discussion with the relatives who have come to pick them up, the dead relatives who have come to pick them up and take them through the dead process, there's quite often time involved. Sometimes the person will say, I'm not ready to go yet. And the relative will say, okay, well, I'll be back tomorrow morning. And then the person dies the next day. So they know when they're going to die, and it's very much a highly structured process.
That is so interesting that you bring that up as well, because I had actually thought that that was the case. You know, that there is a real order to it. And again, with myself, as I was preparing to transition, and in my article I point this out too. I say, well, they're not losing their minds when they're dying. They're actually gaining more consciousness. Because I was getting ready to lapse into a coma, and then I did lapse into a coma, but I was never aware of suddenly going unconscious, as it were, because from my vantage point, I was always conscious and really super alert. So I think it's interesting that people say, oh, that person's losing it, or they're out of it, because I experience quite the contrary of that.
I think that's really interesting, because unfortunately, in our Western culture, there just hasn't been the sort of scientific studies that we need. Now, in the emails that we got, a number of people talked about what happens at the moment of death in our culture, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But in the Tibetan culture. And the Dalai Lama has talked about it in a number of the books he's written about death and dying. You go through just at this terminal bit as you come up to the stopping breathing and what we would normally call death, with the heart stopping and so on. He talks about the mental states that you see. And if I have them in the right order, I think that the first thing that the dying see is a sort of mirage, then smoke, and then a picture of little spots of bright light, what he calls fireflies. And then then breathing stops, and then you see an orange light, then a white light, and then a living blackness. Then you lose consciousness just for a few brief moments. When you come to their system in the clear light of consciousness, where you can, if you want, transcend into a higher state of consciousness. Now, that's what the Tibetans say. Now, if you look at what we say in our culture, it is so similar, it's scary. Because we've got lovely accounts of people saying that when people left the body, they saw that it was rather like a mirage, like the hot waves that you see on the road on a hot summer's day.
Oh, yes.
And somebody else said it was like smoke leaving the body. then somebody else said it was like being surrounded with white light. So it seems as if the stages which the Bettans have recognized are in fact there. And we need to be aware of this and start actually studying it.
And it's so universal, isn't it, when you get a lot of these different accounts. And I notice in your lecture and in your article as well, you had made a very good point that when you were first researching the NDE, that there weren't, you know, that there wasn't so much information circulating about it. So people's accounts were very organic, is the word I've been using for that. Just because they were not influenced by other people's accounts or by media or anything like that. Much like child NDEers who, and I'm also a child NDE as well as an adult NDE. The child NDEers are not so influenced by religion or culture or society or that kind of influence or input. And so their NDEs, their accounts are going to be very different from a lot of them that you see where people see religious figures or what have you. What has your experience in your research, what have you come up with about that? Because I really like how you pointed out that it's so different, isn't it?
That's a very important point, because nowadays, if you take the NDE, one of the points which are held up is that after Raymond Moody's book,
right,
there've been so many accounts now that it's very difficult to get an independent one. Well, in our survey, which we did after our first television program on near-death experiences, we took 500 of the 1,000 letters we got, 2,000 letters we had, took 500, and then asked the people to fill in a questionnaire. And one of the questions we asked, and that was, what did you know about the NDE at the time you had your experience? And 98% of the sample said that at the time they had the experience, they had never come across it. They didn't know anything about it at all. Now, of course, it will never be possible to get a similar sample again to the one that we got then, because now most people have heard of it. But the interesting thing is, when we compare the experiences which occurred before people had heard about it to the experiences that people have now that they've heard about it, they're the same. And the reason that they are the same is that these experiences are very, very powerful. They're not things that people make up.
Indeed.
They're things that people actually experience. So in the near-death experience, I think people are all describing the same thing, and it doesn't matter whether you've heard about it or not.
That's so interesting. So you're really feeling confident then that most people still are not influenced by outer stimuli, so it's still really very much their authentic experience that's being conveyed.
Yes, I think that's right. And the reason, again, that I say that is that anybody who's had a near-death experience will find that they're totally overwhelming, going down the tunnel of light, meeting the being of light, going into a sort of heavenly area, all that type of thing. These are very, very powerful experiences. And in our study, over 70% of the people who had these experiences were transformed. And they were transformed in a really positive way. So it's a very life-changing event. Now, the interesting point about a life change in the NDE, because we work mainly with the cardiac arrest model. These are people whose hearts have stopped.
Okay.
Pim Van Lommel, who I think you're going to have on your program, has done a wonderful study in Holland.
Oh, absolutely.
He compared the way that people whose hearts stopped, but they didn't have a near-death experience, with the way that they changed, and compared them to those whose hearts did stop, and they did have a near-death experience. And what he's shown that although both of those groups changed and were transformed, the ones that were transformed the most were those that in fact did have the near-death experience. So it's not just because you've been very frightened because you got close to death, etc. It is something in the experience itself which transforms you.
Oh, well, I tell you, after going through the ones that I've been through, you indeed are never the same. And I felt a lot more courageous as well as a result of my experiences. And one thing that I would like to ask you that is very important to me is if you can provide an explanation to help people understand the difference between an experience, whether it be an NDE or a deathbed vision, between that and an hallucination, because they are so very, very different. But I think you'd be much better at explaining it than I would.
Yes.
The difference.
A lot of this comes down to the word hallucination. And it's a psychiatric term, and what it means is that you have an apparent sensory experience, and there is nothing out there, there's nothing external to support it. So the argument is that it's brain generated. Now, in the model which we work most closely with, what is very clear is that if people have near-death experiences when their hearts have stopped and their breathing has stopped, then we have to look at this very closely because of the scientific value that this will have as well as the importance that it will have for the people concerned. Now, the model, the cardiac arrest model, is in fact an excellent model of death because not breathing, heart stopped, and all your brainstem reflexes have gone, so you don't cough if somebody puts things into your throat, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, is the clinical definition of death. And those are the people that we're dealing with. Now, when they come back from that state, they say they've had an experience. And as far as we can gather, then that cannot be just a hallucination in a normally functioning brain, because the brain is, of course, quite abnormal at that point. So the only other question is, could it occur before they go unconscious and they remember it, or could it occur after they've been unconscious and they misattribute it to when they are fully unconscious? Now, it can't be before, because many of your listeners will have fainted and you lose consciousness very quickly and you remember everything up to the point that you lose consciousness. So during that time, it can't occur, or you would have remembered that it occurred before the experience. And when you come round from a cardiac arrest, if you've seen people, they're always confused over a long period of time. And so these experiences are not confusional experiences. They're very clear, they're very lucid, and they're quite different from the confusional state. So you have to argue that these are a very specific set of states of experiences that you can't just say were simply hallucinations, because they don't fit that definition.
Oh, I'm just ever so grateful that you are sharing this, because I've been wanting to share this with people for a long time, that there's still, and I admit I don't really understand, that there are still people who will insist that this is a dying brain, and I want to say, how can you come to that conclusion when there's absolutely no brain activity at all? So this is brilliant what you are sharing, and of course I know this to be true, and I've also have noted the real difference between the clarity of the experience, again the near-death experience, and even the deathbed vision. There's a consistency, there's a clarity, there's a sobriety about it, whereas when somebody is hallucinating, it's a very different kind of thing happening altogether. I'm just so grateful that you are sharing this. Now, are there any projects that you are working on now, Dr. Fenech, or anything coming up that you would like to share with our listeners of note?
Well, what we're doing is we're doing the hospital experiment that I was talking about at the beginning of the show, and that's still ongoing now. And when that is all fully set up, then we hope to be able to get people to report what they see in the recovery rooms, and we hope that they'll be able to see the targets that we have in the recovery rooms. And if they do, then that will show us immediately that these experiences occurring when they are in fact unconscious, because it'll be during the time of the resuscitation. And so then that will nail it as far as one is able to. Of course, the next step will be to improve the technology with timings and moving images and so on. But the first thing is to just make sure that it really can and does occur and people can get information. So when we have that, then we can upgrade the studies into more technical ones. So that's one thing we're doing. The other thing that we're doing is, as I mentioned, we're trying to get the information out to people about the deathbed phenomena and what they are. We hope to be bringing a book out towards the end of this year, maybe early next year, describing the experiences that people have had, all those experiences that people have written into us about with the approaching death or the end-of-life experiences. So those are the two projects that we have ongoing at the moment. And, of course, we're collecting more evidence from the hospices themselves and carers in the hospices.
Now, one question I've got regarding this experiment you're doing with having these targets, as it were. What about the NDEs who don't really hoover around their bodies? In other words, who just go straight out and don't really focus on their bodies? And the reason I ask that, too, is because I was one such person. I was very oblivious to my physical body, except when I was making my re-entry into the physical plane, and then I noted the machinery that my body was hooked up to and all of that stuff. But for the most part, I was really far and away from and disinterested in my body. So what have you thought about that?
If we go back to my PhD students, Penny's PhD, when she was looking at people in coronary care units, what she found was that there was a very wide range of what people did. Some people just had a near-death experience and didn't leave their bodies and come into the resuscitation room. They just went straight down the tunnel and met the being of light.
Mm-hmm.
So only about a third of people had the out-of-body experience where they saw the resuscitation room and they saw themselves. And what Penny had done is she had put cards on top of the monitors, you know, around the beds of people who are being resuscitated. There are the cardiac monitors.
Sure.
Well, these are quite high in her unit, and she put cards on those. And we learned a lot from that, because when these people came out of their bodies and looked down, they were only interested in one thing, and that was their body. They weren't interested in looking around the room and saying, gosh, I wonder what the doctors have put around here, which they might be able to see. Nobody who came out of their bodies looked around for the cards which Penny had put on the monitors. So what we had to redesign it this time so that when they came out of their bodies and looked back at their bodies, they'll also see the targets which we have in the resuscitation rooms. And so it's just slightly different than it was before. And only about a third of the people of near-death experiences will in fact do that. The others won't. And what we'll do is we'll collect all the experiences, but some will be straightforward near-death experiences, and only a third will be ones in which people leave their bodies.
Well, that is really tremendous. I'm so pleased that you've joined us. My goodness, this hour has fled by, and we've already come to the end of this transmission of Toward the Light. We've been speaking with Dr. Peter Finnick in London, who's a foremost researcher on the near-death experience and also the deathbed visions or deathbed phenomena. I would like to invite you to join us next week when we'll have Mr. Ned Doherty as our special guest. And yes, we were talking about Dr. Pim Van Lommel, who will be our guest on the 14th October. So you want to be sure and tune in at that time. You've been listening to Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is Reverend Juliet Nightingale reminding you that it is only with the heart that one sees rightly. What is essential is invisible to the eye. Please remember that only love prevails. Visit our website, towardthelight.org, and also towardthelight.info. Blessings and light to all of you. Thank you once again, Dr. Peter Finnick, and we will speak to all of you next week. Blessings and light.